Horror Writers Podcast, episode number 47. All right, and welcome back to the Horror Writers Podcast, the show with two horror authors discussing all things in the world of horror. I'm Zach Bohan, and with me, as always, is Jay Thorne. How you doing, Jay?
Doing great, Zach. How you doing, man?
I'm good, man. I'm really excited about the episode today. Today we have two guests from the film world, two directors who co-directed a movie together called Spring. We've got Justin Benson. How you doing, Justin?
Good. What's up, guys?
Much. Thanks for coming on. And we've also got Aaron Moorhead. How you doing, Aaron?
Doing great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for sure for coming on. So kind of as I said in the introduction, Justin and Aaron directed a movie together called Spring. Jay and I both, I guess a good way to introduce it is the way I found out about this movie, because I want to give credit where credit's due, is a few weeks ago on the horror show with Brian Keene, horror author Brian Keene, and his co-host Dave Thomas, had mentioned that they'd seen this movie, and they both said it was like their favorite movie they've seen this year, in the last year or so. So it got me intrigued, and I checked it out. I tweeted about it to one of our listeners, and to Eldridge Black, and Justin caught the tweet, and now we're here. So, I guess, do one of you guys want to kind of, just to start out, I guess first off, how did you guys come together for this project? Might be kind of a good place to start.
Which one of us? Hey, I'll take this one. we've been working together for quite a while. We met as interns in 2009. As interns, we just kind of like got along, but we kind of kept in touch and started working together more and more and more, and realized that we have a lot of the same taste. And so after doing some like spec ads and short films and stuff like that together, Justin came up with Resolution, which was our first film. And we made Resolution together on just like a, you know, out of Justin's checking account. And we, and that was kind of like one of those things where it was like a total shot in the dark. We knew it was really cool, but it was kind of a weird film. We kind of expected it to be pretty polarizing. But we decided to just like, you know, bet big, and we sent it out to every like top tier film festival we could find. And rumor has it, it was rejected by an intern at the Tribeca Film Festival, but then like a junior programmer saw it in the trash and had read like the program notes and was like, wow, this actually sounds kind of cool, and like literally pulled it out of the trash and watched it. And pulled it out of the trash and watched it, and then programmed it at the Tribeca Film Festival. And from then on, we had careers as directors, and you know, we've been working together ever since.
Yeah. Have you guys checked out Resolution by any chance?
Not yet. No.
No, not yet. No.
If you liked Spring, you'll dig it quite a bit. There is like it's funny. It's like there is a thing that gets said, not all the time, but sometimes it's like people will be like, oh, I like it, but it's not quite as good as Resolution. We in our heart of hearts don't believe that. They're good in different ways, but we're very proud of Resolution, and the guys in it, Pierce Lola and Minnie Cran, are like both like amazing performers, and it's cool. It's a really cool micro budget creepy little movie.
Nice.
So where if we want to watch Resolution, where can we do that?
Amazon Prime is probably the best way to watch it for free.
Oh, but sweet. Okay.
If you don't want to watch it for free, which is totally fine by us, it's on iTunes and you know, Blu-ray, DVD, and all of that. It was a pretty successful little like sleeper hit.
The Blu-ray is literally, you can't fit any more data on it. It's a good Blu-ray purchase. There's some fun stuff on that.
Yeah, the Blu-ray's actually, hang on. Let's pitch the Blu-ray even further, because it is genuinely one of the the movie's pretty weird, and that's kind of how we sold it. But like it is definitely the weirdest Blu-ray special features you will ever find. There are three commentaries. One is me and him. One is me, him, the cast, and our producer all getting extremely drunk. And by the end of it, it's just like a mess, like a complete mess. And then the third, I don't want to say much because it's a bit of a spoiler for the film, but I'll just say it's the third commentary is by a dog. And I mean like a real dog, like a dog barking for like an hour and a half.
But a dog with a PhD in film studies.
Yeah, very, very smart. Very perceptive dog. There's an alternate trailer that makes it look like Brokeback Mountain. Like, the film is like dead serious. Like, you got just, never mind.
You might have me sold. Like, I've actually been trying to get rid of my physical stuff, like, and try to go digital with everything, but you might have me sold on that Blu-ray. So that sounds awesome.
Well, that's the thing. If you got to make a Blu-ray, like, what's the only reason? I don't even own any Blu-rays anymore. Like, what's the only reason to buy a Blu-ray? Is, like, the special features have to not just be, like, a behind the scenes of, like, the actor being like, oh, my God, it was so inspiring to work with the director. And, like, my co-actors were so inspiring. And we were shooting over here, and it was inspiring. Like, if it's that, then it's like, I hate your Blu-ray. Go away. You know? We just decided to make something, most of our special features completely dismantle the film. There is no film itself in our special features.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'll definitely be sure. In the show notes, we'll link to the both versions. We'll link to the digital version and to the superior Blu-ray version as well. So we'll make sure so if anyone's interested in checking that out, and you don't want to just go look it up on Amazon, then I'll be sure to have the links in the show notes. So now, when did you guys do that movie together?
Oh man, it came out Tribeca. It played Tribeca in 2012.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, released in 2013.
Yeah.
Awesome. Oh man, that's 3 years ago now.
Jay, I'll turn it over to you.
I don't think we kind of discussed any rules around spoilers, so maybe what we can do is, as we talk about the film, we won't talk about the ending until pretty close to the end, and then maybe we'll give a spoiler alert. Does that sound good, everyone?
Yeah.
All right. So I'm sure you guys have done this a million times, but can you give us the quick 30-second version of what Spring is about for people who have never heard of it?
Yeah, it's about a young man who flees Southern California in an emotional and legal tailspin, takes a random nowhere trip to Italy, and when he gets there, he sparks up a romance with a girl with a dark secret. And I think to take it any further than that is spoiling it a little bit, but we're going to do that anyways.
Excellent. All right, so that's a great place to start, and I've been wanting to ask you about the setting of the film. I felt like once your characters got to Italy, I was just completely enthralled by the movie. Like, I was captivated. It was beautiful. I mean, in many, many ways. So it seems as though that setting played a really important role in your story. And I was wondering if maybe you could kind of give us some insight on your choice of setting and how it did play into the story.
Yeah, we it's interesting because we did get asked that question a few times, like, was it always written for Italy? And that's a different question than yours. But it was kind of, to hear that was for the first time when we started getting interviewed about Spring, was kind of like, oh, I guess there's a chance this film wasn't in Italy, but yeah, it was always in Italy, like from draft one, like from inception of it. And the reason isn't like, man, wouldn't it be cool to go shoot a movie in Italy, although that's obviously a wonderful perk. But the script reasons were that a lot of this has to do with the origin of myth. And a lot of our myths come from, first the old world, but like kind of like a common culture that occupies mental real estate for all of us, where everybody kind of knows the history of Rome. Nobody quite knows the history of Montenegro. You know what I mean? And there's some kind of, there's like a primordial connection we have to it. And so this idea that Louise is, oh man, I'm already spoiling. I have to, I'm sorry.
All right, go ahead. This is your warning, everybody.
This isn't the ending, but this is at least the third act turn. You know, but the idea that Louise is kind of a skeleton key for a lot of our myths, you know, like maybe somebody cited her once and came up with the myth of a vampire or a werewolf or something like that. Maybe they caught the wrong angle or a wrong glimpse on her and they came up with, you know, Cthulhu-like sea creature, you know, something like that. And all of that, you know, you can see that being seeded throughout history with someone who lives in this area that's extraordinarily old. Yeah. And then that also, by the way, ties into religion, which, you know, Rome was the capital of religion for how many years? I'm sorry, the capital of the Christian religion for how many years? And so so that's a lot of the that's a lot of like the theoretical ones. And then on a practical level, there were a couple of things. One is actually, Justin, you can take this. I was more talking about how you'd been there, and then us like actually scouting other countries is what I was going to talk about.
Oh yeah. Just so, for all the reasons Aaron said, it was important for story reasons why it was set in Italy. From a practical standpoint, it was written for a little town along the Amalfi Coast, specifically the town of Atrani, I believe it's called. And the reason was just because I had been there a couple of times on family vacations. And so I had a mental map of this little town in my head. So, you know, you're writing a scene and it just helps if you know the space a little bit and what's there and the geography of this town. We came to find out that shooting in the Amalfi Coast is extremely expensive. Like the only things that like really shoot there are like, well, the town of Mr. Ripley was shot there, but like James Bond movies and luxury item commercials that are very, very, very expensive. And there was no way we could do it with as an indie film. And in general, shooting an indie film in Italy was frowned upon by producers because it has a reputation for being a difficult place to shoot on the cheap. And not to mention, especially at the time, that the dollar was pretty weak against the euro. But we got really, really, really lucky in that there was a little town in the Apulia region of Italy that was almost exactly like the town on the Amalfi Coast in the script. And not only that, but that region, Apulia, had tax credits, film funds, all that types of stuff, and they really wanted to bring in film productions. So they were extremely accommodating. That was something we got so lucky on. And that the common knowledge among almost every single producer we talked to was like, don't do it, don't shoot in Italy. And somehow that worked out. At the time, the place to shoot everything was like Jakarta, like where they did Raid and Raid 2. Like in terms of like getting value, it was like that or like maybe Colombia. You know, that would have been pretty substantial changes to the script.
We even tried other places. Like we went to the Cannes Film Festival trying to just like arrange everything, but specifically trying to like look into things like the Canary Islands or Montenegro, just alternate locations to shoot. We actually ended up scouting Montenegro and it was gorgeous. It just wasn't right. And it's really hard as an indie filmmaker. And when I say indie, I don't mean like P.T. Anderson indie. I mean like we spent every dime we had getting to the Cannes Film Festival and like everything that would work, you know. So like, so to actually be like, this is not right on like an artistic level, but it wasn't. It just wasn't. It wasn't the right thing. You know, nobody knows where Montenegro is, even though it's gorgeous and perfect and everything. It's just kind of like this weird. It's an odd thing to base a movie around, unfortunately, and so. And then luckily, you know, Italy also worked out perfectly for us. And then, you know, the Canary Islands, we were kind of just couldn't, you know, even looking at location photos, we're just like, it's just not quite working. And, but, you know, when we just happened to find like this perfect crew and perfect cast and producer and everything actually worked out completely flawlessly.
Awesome. Zach, you want to take one?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, you know, obviously the movie definitely crosses some genre lines big time. You know, I hate to ask this question because, you know, Jay and I, we come from we come from the music background. Like, he and I both played in heavy metal bands forever, and you can't just say you're in a heavy metal band. You have to say, I'm in a Scandinavian death black metal whatever band. But when, like, how do you guys categorize the movie when people ask you? Like, I mean, like I said, because it's kind of, it kind of teeters a few different lines.
We got, we got asked that a whole lot, and it's always been a bit of a question, because for us, like that, as you said, like that's a marketing question, and yeah. It's something that as someone who's self-aware about our own careers, like we do need to know the marketing questions and the marketing answers, and so, you know, now it's pretty easy. We say, you know, it's a love story that has kind of a Lovecraftian angle to it, and that works pretty well for
that's
most.
That's exactly what I thought. Yeah.
But when we were trying to pitch it, a lot of the times that would cause like a record skip in people's minds and was made it actually a hard sell.
Awesome. I'd love to kind of get into some of the character analysis and some questions around that if you guys are up for it. One character in particular I was fascinated by, and probably not the first one most people go to, but I believe his name was Angelo, the old guy on the farm. This seems like there was a lot going on there, and I was wondering if you could give us maybe a little peek behind the curtain as to, you know, who he was or sort of what his part was in this bigger story.
Justin, you want to grab that one because I've been talking a bit?
Oh, yeah. Man, you got me on this one. I haven't answered that question in so long. I think this is oversimplifying it, you know, people live their lives and they see patterns in life, and they see kind of like the same things happen over and over again. And I think the definition of that is wisdom, right? That's why older people describe them as being wiser than a younger person. And that putting Evan in this situation with this older guy who has wisdom, a guy who has seen things repeat happening over again and acquired wisdom in life. But the thing he brought out of it was a sort of silence. That a lot of times he just lets Evan talk, and then he'll say something that's, you know, it's not speaking down to him or speaking down to the audience, but kind of like humble universal truths about life. But a lot of times in the way he does it, it's through like silence and not talking. I think that's a good way to put it about Angelo. What else about Angelo, Aaron?
Yeah, I remember, you know, when we were talking about the beginning of the script is something that was always in there, but Lou Taylor Pucci, the leader of the thing, really brought to the surface was that ultimately a lot of the events of the script are lead back to the death of his mother. And so in the very beginning, we kind of played it for comedy, but also we played it for comedy and for drama, is the fact that he's surrounded by a whole bunch of grown men who have no idea what to do or what to say to this guy who's just lost his mother. They just, you know, revert to man-child status. And then he goes over to England, and he keeps on meeting these people that are just no good for him, basically. And Angelo was kind of the end button to that theme, like meeting him and his throughout, in that he has this wisdom, but also his advice isn't always great. And his advice, we tried to kind of like make a human out of the wise person trope that you see a lot. You know, that's kind of become a bit of a cliched thing, where it's just like there's this old wise person that just will hand you the keys to the kingdom. And he actually does have the keys of the kingdom, but it's not in what he says. It's only really in what he does. And in fact, actually, there's one line that we cut out of the movie because what he said was the right thing. And we just like, wait, we don't want him to say the right thing. We only want him to do the right thing. And there was this part where ran up to Angelo as he drove off in his truck, and he says, Angelo, or he says, I'm sorry, actually, before that happened, he said, yeah, she broke up with me, and he goes, oh, you're stupid, you know, that kind of thing, and he goes, oh, you know, Italian women, right? And it used to be that he says, are you a fighter? And he says, you know, I try to be. He's like, you have to fight, you have to be persistent, something like that, which sounds cheesy coming out of my mouth, but it was much better written in Justin's script, and something like that. And like, and in that moment, Evan took it to heart and was kind of thinking, like, you're right, I do need to just try one more time. And we realized that it's like, it was kind of against this idea of what Angelo really was, which was his actions were right, but his advice was very whatever, take it or leave it. And ultimately, like, you know, in being, yeah, it was kind of like an action speak louder than words thing.
I got the sense that this wasn't his first Evan, that he had, you know, he'd been in this rodeo before, and maybe he was even a bit tired. Like maybe early on he had these experiences and he was very explicit with his advice, and now he was getting old and tired and was just clamming up a little bit more. I don't know, that was my impression, but I kind of thought, like, yeah, this guy's been there before.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So what, something else I'd like to talk about, you know, we've talked about the characters a little bit, and we've talked about the setting, and I agree with Jay, like the setting, like once they got to Italy and stuff, it was just a gorgeous movie. A lot of the overhead shots you guys got and stuff was awesome. But you know, in a lot of the downfall to a lot of, you know, in independent horror films, a lot of times is the effects. But I thought the visuals and the effects in this movie were awesome. Especially, you know, and this is kind of spoilery, but I think we're kind of past that anyway. But the part when Evan first discovers, like, what she is, that whole scene was awesome. I mean, it was really creepy, and it looked very real. And I don't know if there's really a question wrapped up in this as much as just a comment of how good it looked. But, I mean, do you want to maybe talk a little bit about the overall direction of the effects?
Yeah. First off, I'll tell you something really, really interesting that kind of goes against the common sentiment about effects work in films. The shot you're talking about that, and everyone always compliments that. It's great. It's really good. That's the only CG shot in the movie. So, you know, people always talk about, oh, practical this, practical that. It's the only one that's actually a generated shot in the movie. There's compositing in the movie, but that's the only one that's 3D CG everything. And that's the one that everyone points at and goes, like, oh, that's so cool. That's so great. So interesting. But general philosophy for us is that we do everything we possibly can practically, and then we send it home, augment however we can in post. And that doesn't usually mean, like, 3D CG stuff. That usually means additional compositing. And in this case, it meant that we went back to the effects house and did the practical effects with our locked cut. And we created additional things to, like, put on her skin, but did them practically, shot them at the studio, and then inserted them into the movie on her. It's funny because, like, you know, it's always, you know, there's always that debate of, like, practical versus CG, visual effects, whatever. But it's like there's somewhere in between, and it really is about, I think the best stuff is the stuff that uses both worlds.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the best effect you had was that little red dress in the first scene where Louise shows up.
Oh,
wow! I follow Evan's eyes. I was like, "That's great special effects right there."
It's good to hear you mention that, because there was plenty of debate. And Justin, we're not two guys that are like, we got to deal with this red dress situation, but. But there was lots and lots of debate about exactly what that needed to be. You know, what's too showy? What's like, hey, I don't want to look like I'm dressed like for the nightclub in the middle of a plaza in Italy, but also it has to be really, really eye-catching. But if I look like I'm also in a perfume ad, then there's something kind of bizarre and inhuman about that in a movie that is not like that. So there's lots and lots and lots of debate. And we didn't have the budget to be like, well, let's just tailor the right dress, you know?
Yeah.
Let's go buy that $500 dress, you know?
Well, no, it was brilliant because even – and then, the dialogue played right into it because Evan, at first he thinks she's a prostitute or she's going to, steal his wallet in the back alley or something. But he's not entirely sure. So I think that the dress was ambiguous enough that it made you wonder, like, yeah, is she – she's just really good looking, or is there like something else going on there?
Yeah, yeah.
Should we talk a little bit about the ending since we've already given the spoiler alert? What do you think, Zach?
Yeah, I'm totally down with that. Did you have a specific maybe question you wanted to start with, or?
I guess it's it is going to be a spoiler, but as a writer myself, I'm always curious as to how you decided on that ending. I mean, you got 1,000 possibilities. Was this an ending you had in mind from the very beginning, or was this something that sort of evolved as you were writing the screenplay or in earlier treatments? How did you decide on that particular ending?
There you go, this one.
Yeah, I mean, the ending ever since the first draft that I ever read was exactly that, with like one little line added. You know, after we just had kind of an interesting experience, we're like, hey, what if we added this line? And that was it. Just beyond that beyond that, it was always exactly that. The idea was always that we don't really want, the movie tries to deal with love what we were trying to do is in an unmoralistic way, in a way that we're not going to say, hey, love is this one thing, and if you can make it that one thing, then that's what it is, you know. In this case, it's like, no, it's this big tangled ball of things that contradict each other all the damn time. And but we also need an ending, and that requires a choice. And the other option in this specific case is she turns into a monster and, like, murders him.
Yeah.
And frankly, like, we actually heard that a lot of people wanted that, but man, does that feel like it goes against the sensibility of the movie, which is strange because a lot of people were right up on edge for the end of it, but for us in our first cuts, we were really concerned that people would call the ending miles away. Very, very concerned. Just being like, well, I mean, they're spending all their damn time together, and it's like the sweetest thing in the world. Like, of course she's going to choose to do that. And actually, that was part of the development of the script was, even though we knew where it ended, we were just like, we need to have her not choose these things anymore. Like, oxytocin, for example, has to choose for her. Mm-hmm. Something that she just can't help. Her mind doesn't matter anymore. It's only her heart, right? And so that was really cool that it tied in, because it ties into the whole biochemistry idea of the whole film. And or biochemistry and love being, one's tangible, the other one's not, but ultimately they're very, very, very interrelated. And and trying to romanticize that idea is very difficult, but I hope we did that. And and then another thing was besides the oxytocin thing, is we needed to have her resist and resist and resist. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, we had to make Evan more and more and more tenacious. But that also that's one of those great examples of, once you really realize and understand your characters and story, it all kind of seems to lay out for you anyways, because Evan's main trait is that he's extraordinarily impulsive. So who better than the most impulsive guy in the world to be the person that's like, nope, I love you, let's get married, I want to be a dad, to this monster. You know, like, who better than the most impulsive guy in the world? Evan. And so it was like, all right, this works. Evan will be pushing, she'll be resisting, therefore we can't call the ending. And that's how it ended up working out.
I thought it was brilliant. I felt like it worked on multiple angles. I felt as though Evan deserved her. He seemed to earn it. And in a weird way, like, why you'd want to earn that, but he did. And mm-hmm. and I felt like, too, it was a comment on love in general, and that she had been around for thousands of years, and yet this was the guy that she could not resist. And so it kind of worked from both sides. I thought it was very clever.
Yeah, he's the least extraordinary person in real life, but he's the most extraordinary person in that he's the first one for her,
yeah,
which is really cool. And then also, actually, The guy who played the bartender in the beginning, Vinny, he was the star of our last film, Resolution. And he said something in the behind-the-scenes in Spring that's really poignant. He said, help me out with this, Justin, but it was something like, it was like, so she's been, like, dating, you know, princes and all these beautiful guys from, like, the Romantic era, but somehow seemed to settle for the unemployed guy during the Kardashian era. She didn't... she didn't choose anything. She committed suicide.
But it's interesting though, because that is why the ending is honest. It's because in real life, people don't fall in love with the person that looks good on paper. It's not something just like romanticizing. People really typically don't. Yeah. You fall in love with the person that you maybe even on, if you made a list before you met that person of traits, the things you're, you probably don't want, not attracted to, or don't want to spend your life with, you'll probably still fall in love and end up with someone that has those traits because there's just that weird, mysterious thing, right? But yeah, that's kind of the point. Then the other thing too, I mean, the worst thing we could have done in terms of stale, predictable material is have him literally have to spend himself from a monster in the last act of a movie that no matter how you categorize it, there's still a monster in it, and it's still a horror film. And if you go with that ending, you've kind of violated all the fresh and unique stuff that came before. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with movies that end with fighting the monster. There's lots of great ones. It's just, if you could do something different, and if you've made this movie where the ultimate question became, is she in love, the thing we don't really choose, mm-hmm. and you're getting tension from that and the monster stuff, it's still adding tension, but it kind of goes into the background a little bit. I don't know. Much more proud of that version than, you know, think about that last shot. I haven't seen anything like fighting a monster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would kind of cheapen that experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I thought the ending was definitely it was the right ending for the movie for sure. You know, and it kind of goes back to what I was saying a little bit ago when I asked you about the genre. I mean, because, you know, certain genres do have, you know, certain, conventions. And, you know, I think that it seems that maybe a lot of the people who were disappointed in the ending, maybe, like, you know, were expecting more of a horror movie. You know what I'm saying? Like, and it definitely has those elements, but it definitely has all those romance elements, too. But, yeah, the movie, I thought the ending was great, and it was definitely the right ending. So I definitely agree with you on that. So, well, we're coming up on kind of the 30-minute mark here. We're just a little past it. Jay, did you have any other questions you wanted to get to or ask? Or
No, I didn't have any other questions, but I know Zach will close us out, but I just wanted to personally thank you guys for spending some time with us and talking about the film. I really enjoyed it. I didn't know anything about it until Zach told me about it, and I was surprised at how good it was, and I mean that as a true compliment. It was, you know... Indie films like indie books would kind of work in those same circles, and sometimes, you know, the quality can really run the gamut. But Spring was fantastic. I would strongly encourage any of our listeners who are tuning in here to check it out. You will not be disappointed. And it's visually stunning. It's character driven, and it's fresh. It's unique, and I think, you know, for that reason alone, it's worth seeing. So I just want to thank you guys.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
So. I guess important question, what's next? You guys are working on anything right now or got any plans or?
Man, I wish I could tell you any one big thing. We've got a whole lot of stuff on the burner. But you know, to kind of give you an idea, we have a movie about Aleister Crowley. That's in casting.
Nice. And
yeah. We got a movie about Aleister Crowley. We have a kind of like a big-ish kind of like Looper scale movie. That's about an android trying to find his creator at the end of the world. And yeah, that one's really awesome. And then we have a couple of TV shows and then some stuff that we got to keep quiet about. But yeah,
right on.
It's busy, 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 and it's looking really good.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all stuff that you guys are doing together.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah, definitely.
Nice. Well, it's good you guys found that good partnership and work together well, because I know that can be difficult to find sometimes with you know, art. So in
no,
general. So.
Justin made me sign a 25-year contract when we worked together first, so I'm kind of just stuck.
Yeah,
and also, I thought it was weird. I was like, what do I have to lose? It's not like I'm gonna, you know, I mean, it's not like this is gonna do anything.
Yeah, it's been really good for me though. I just, because I don't have to do anything really. I have like lots of time now, and like I've really gotten into going to the gym. I've been going on like dates and stuff, and playing video games. Because Aaron just does everything, and I just like feel it's awesome.
Yeah,
it does.
That's a great deal.
Honestly, you know, he was like Samwise Gamgee. He told me to share the load, and I thought that's what it was. But ultimately, I just took the whole ring all the way to Mordor.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Well played.
Jay and I have some collaborative projects in the works, and that's kind of how I am. I'm just gonna like let him do everything and just whatever. You know? So
yeah,
that's the way to go, Justin.
Yeah. Jay, I'll send you my 25-year contract template.
Yeah, I could definitely use that. Thanks.
Yeah. You guys have never met, right?
Like in person, you've never met in person.
No.
What the hell?
No.
Wild. You guys are.
We might soon. Yeah.
On like every single level, because of the way the Google Hangouts is, you guys can't be more opposite. Like you're like one of you is in a bright studio, one is in like a dark cave. One's got this like long rocker hair, one's shaved his head. Like you guys are like total opposite badasses. And I kind of like the fact that you've never met either. So just that like sends it all home.
Nice.
Yeah, we're hoping to change that soon. We're hoping to meet soon, but
oh, I thought you were gonna. Yeah. Sure. Okay.
Well, cool. Well, I guess that about does it. So we again, like Jay said, thank you guys for coming on. We really appreciate it. And everyone, go check out these guys' movies. Check out Spring, and we'll have all the links to everything we talked about in the show notes. So, all right, take care. Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks, dudes.
Thanks for listening to the Horror Writers Podcast. If you have any thoughts or questions about today's show, please feel free to leave us a comment. Subscribe on iTunes and on YouTube. If you like us, please leave us a review on iTunes. The Horror Writers Podcast can be found on the web at thehorrorwriterspodcast.com. All graphics provided by Johnny Diggs at diggscreative.com. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode.